I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Today, a conversation about the greater impact prosecutors can have on criminal justice reform. We'll speak with a former assistant district attorney who now works to make jail the last option that prosecutors pick. Then we'll get an update on organized labor in Missouri. State lawmakers and Governor Greitens passed right-to-work legislation in February. Will the rule sound a death knell for unions, or will it be a boon? After that, Bill Brownlee brings us this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Up to Date has had any number of conversations about crime. We've talked with local grassroots anti-crime organizations, highlighted alliances of various government and law enforcement agencies, and spoken with judges about special courts and the chief of police about the policies and methods employed by the department. We've spent time with public defenders who are overworked and underfunded, and with a prosecuting attorney for Jackson County to learn about efforts underway to reduce crime. But in all those conversations with all those people, we miss something. That something is what a prosecutor decides when a case file lands on his or her desk. Adam Foss recognized this gap early on in his pursuit of a law career, and it is now the focus of his organization, Prosecutor Impact. Foss is a former assistant district attorney in the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office in Boston. Now he advocates for criminal justice reform and the importance of the role of the prosecutor in ending mass incarceration. Adam Foss joins us this morning from WERS at Emerson University in Boston. Adam, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I bet if you asked a room full of people what is the job of a prosecutor, most of them would say it's to put criminals in jail. Are they wrong?
They're wrong in terms of that's not what we are supposed to be doing. They're probably right in terms of what they've seen, what the reputation of a prosecutor is to do.
When you entered law school, what did you think prosecutors were supposed to do?
When I entered law school, I really didn't know what prosecutors were supposed to do. I had my own interactions with them in the criminal justice system, and I thought that their job was to get the bad people off the street. As I went on through law school and had my own experiences with interacting with them and then finally going to work for them, I realized that the job was much broader in terms of our fundamental goals are to increase public safety and to do fairness and justice to make sure that happens.
Hmm. What type of law did you want to practice originally?
I went into law school sort of, you know, not really understanding what I was getting into, and I thought I'd be an entertainment lawyer because it sounded good, and I thought maybe, you know, I can hang out with some cool celebrities.
Somewhere along the way, you got religion here, it sounds like.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, what changed your mind? How did you get to criminal law?
A series of small experiences that ended up being life-altering, the first being an internship at the end of my first year of law school in a criminal court in a really impoverished neighborhood in Boston, and just sort of seeing the inefficiency and the unfairness of our justice system that, as taxpayers, we pay for. The following year, working for a defense attorney here in Boston who exposed me to people who committed really, really serious crime, and being able to interact with those folks and see humanity in people who actually committed crime. And then finally, my third year of law school, representing people on my own, having my own clients and seeing their humanity and seeing how ineffective and inefficient the criminal justice system was.
Well, let's get into what your work is all about now, because the model for what a prosecutor is supposed to accomplish, meaning win cases with a conviction, has been in place for a long time. You're working to change that mindset to what exactly?
That winning does not mean convicting a person or winning a trial. That winning means that making sure that the person on the other side of the courtroom doesn't reoffend, making sure that the person who has been victimized is made to feel whole, and making sure that the community as a whole is whatever harm has been done to it is repaired.
How far does the system have to go to get where you'd like it to be, Adam?
To get where I'd like it to be, it's probably a longer term solution. The good news for us is that we're literally starting with the same justice system that we had hundreds and hundreds of years ago. So I say that to offer encouragement, and that small little increments of progress will have a profound impact on the way that we practice day to day.
Rather than becoming a criminal defense attorney, you chose to become a prosecutor. Explain for our listeners just how powerful the prosecutor is, what decisions are made each step along the way from the time the case lands on his or her desk.
Sure, and I'll use a recent case example. There's a young man in the Bronx who was recently charged as an adult for murdering his mother's abusive boyfriend. And the prosecutor in that case is going to be in the position to say, here's a situation that I can investigate. And when I do this investigation, I'm going to have a variety of things that I can do with this case. If I deem that this actually was a case of self-defense or defense of another, I don't have to charge this case at all. If I decide that it's something a little bit more than self-defense, that maybe this young man went a little too far, I still don't have to charge this young man with first-degree murder and send him to prison for the rest of his life. There are many options in between simply dismissing a case and convicting someone for life without parole, that as a prosecutor, my decisions can influence what ultimately happens.
I'm just struck by the fact that the system seems more concerned with winning than for best outcomes here. What happened? Why did it get to that place? Why is it the way it is?
It is the way that it is because when the system was created, for some reason, we thought that this was the best way to do things. And back then, when we were creating things, we didn't rely a lot upon like data or you know, testing a model. It was written by a group of white men in some room hundreds and hundreds of years ago, and we got stuck with it. In doing that, we sort of conditioned ourselves to believe that winning a trial and getting long sentences was a good outcome. A person has done something bad, and so if we convict them and we send them to prison for a long time, we're sending a message. What we know now in our history and frankly by studying this is that the trial process and the plea bargaining process and the length of sentences don't make us any safer. What outcomes make us safer are education, housing, employment, pro-social activities, better communities, healthier communities. And until we start to measure those things in prosecutors' offices, then we're going to continue operating on the metrics that we do now, which is how many cases do you win?
No, but that means spending more money on a system that the public has no interest in spending money on. Just out here in Kansas City right now, we're having a huge issue with the Jackson County Jail, where Kansas City is located, overcrowded, not enough guards. The state of Kansas, similar problems with its prisons in El Dorado and in Lansing. The politics here are tough because people don't want to spend more money here, Adam.
Yeah, and it's this really ironic problem because what people don't recognize is how much money they've been spending already and that it's not making things better. We're literally throwing money at a problem that is only growing instead of taking a step back and saying, if we do it differently this way, yes, there are going to be upfront costs that we're going to have to bear, but in the long term, we're going to be spending a lot less money than we are right now.
If you're just joining us, this is Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Our guest is Adam Foss, who works on showing prosecutors the beneficial alternatives to punishing criminals with a prison term. That model you're talking about here, winning the case, the model that currently exists, does that preclude district attorneys from seeing the defendant as a person and as an individual?
We do this really terrible job of dehumanizing the people who have committed crimes into the act that they've committed. So a person's a murderer, a person's a thief, a person's a sex offender. We've dehumanized them and taken away anything we see about them except the act that they've committed. And the problem there is that lots of environmental and behavioral factors, biological factors, go into why a person commits crime. And the entire time that I was a prosecutor, I met very few criminals. I met a lot of people who ended up in a courtroom at the end of the line. And unless you can be empathetic to that, even when they've done something really bad, then you're not going to have a good outcome. You're going to continue to do this sort of like, I need to punish you and beat you, instead of thinking about what is my long-term goal for this person, for the community that they live in, for the victim who was victimized by this person.
Some folks listening to this might conclude that Adam Foss is a softie when it comes to criminal justice. What do you say to that?
I say that I'm very used to hearing that. It usually comes from people who have not been impacted by the criminal justice system. It usually comes from people who have the privilege to cast stones about people who commit crime, people who are the victims of crime, people who are enforcing crime. There's not, to me, there's not such a thing as soft on crime when it comes to our criminal justice system, unless we're literally letting people walk out the door. What I'm suggesting is that we need a better understanding of why people commit crime so we can intervene to prevent it in the first place. If that's soft on crime, then I would like to hear from other people what they suggest that is more effective than incarcerating people, spending lots and lots of money, having them come back out and go back to the communities where they live to reoffend.
You travel the country to educate prosecuting attorneys about the alternatives they have. You say you are seeing a level of frustration among some over, this lack of choice and that their wish is to make jail the last option here. What does incarceration in this country cost taxpayers each year? What do we know about that?
So short-term answer is $80 billion a year just in structure. So that's labor, that's maintenance of the facilities, et cetera. What is often left out of the conversation are the social costs of having people come out who are not prepared to be integrated into society, having people come out that are unemployable, that are mentally ill or otherwise disabled, or they're collecting Social Security. We're paying for all of these social systems for people to survive when they're leaving from prison. And so the social cost, by some estimates, is in hundreds of billions of dollars per year is being spent just on the aftermath of mass incarceration.
You say we're spending those dollars that we do spend too late in the criminal justice process. When and how would you rather see it spent?
I would rather see it spent on early childhood education, on mental health treatment for young people who live in poverty and see trauma. I would love to see ways that we can help young people successfully complete high school, get into college, successfully complete college, and get career jobs, not jobs at McDonald's. And to the extent that we still need to do it, having people learn skills in prison or in jail that will help on the back end, and then finally helping people who are coming out of those places reintegrate. There's a continuum of money where we could spend it correctly and intelligently, where we'd get better outcomes. And if you think about it in terms of just education, imagine if we gave kids a terrible education and then just paid a ton of money for their SAT prep. That's what we're doing in the criminal justice system. We don't
That's
spend any
interesting.
money as people are coming through or going to jail, but then we'll spend a lot of money on reentry, which is not productive.
We've seen success here in our metro area with something called drug courts and veterans courts, and we've asked why the approach used in these special courts isn't used throughout the criminal court system. Is that what you're advocating for, that more people be given greater consideration on their cases?
Yeah, what I'm advocating for is that we stop seeing crime as a crime problem with crime solutions. A lot of the crime, and people who are in the criminal justice system or in the advocacy world see this all the time, a lot of crime is the result of poor health of communities, poor health of individuals, poor mental health. And imagine a medical system where we just treated everybody the same. We didn't have individualized treatment plans for folks. It wouldn't work out. And I know that it's difficult for people to equate being sick and needing hospital care and being sick and committing crime. But when you look at sort of the populations of people who are coming through our jails and prisons, who are constantly tied up in the criminal justice system, these are people who in some way, shape, or form need help and treatment, and it's better for the rest of us.
If we keep defendants out of jail by choosing an alternative plan, like, finishing school, reparations, community service, where do we get the people to oversee these defendants to make sure they're meeting the goals they've set for themselves?
So what you're talking about is restorative justice. How do we move to a more restorative justice model? Frankly, we employ a lot of people. Taxpayers employ a lot of people that I'm sure would rather be doing that job, and they're called probation officers. Probation officers, I'm sure, if you ask them, would rather be helping people, connecting people to services, making sure that they're following through on things that are going to make them better, and having the engagement of that person because they're not acting like probation officers, than chasing people around and trying to figure out what they're doing wrong. The second part of that, a lot of pushback against reform, especially in smaller communities, is that the more you decarcerate, you're going to be closing facilities. When you close facilities, people are losing jobs. I would love to see a place where we are training correctional officers and prison guards and parole officers to think about what does this job look like as a community liaison to people who are returning citizens or people who are in pretrial services.
I was going to say, you know, for so long in this country, the political momentum has been behind the idea of locking people up. And now you do see the pendulum swinging back. What are you seeing just broadly across the country when it comes to where we are and what our thinking is and what we're willing to look at when it comes to criminal justice reform?
You know, it's really a matter of understanding and observing what the criminal justice system actually is. A lot of people have this idea about it because of what they've seen on television, what they've read, but the public courthouse was made public for a reason. It's encouraged that people go and take a morning to sit in the courtroom and see what's happening and see if all of the people in there need to be in there and if all the people that are in there need to be going to jail. And if you're getting the money out of your tax dollars that you're spending on a criminal justice system that you think is up to snuff, if not, doing something about it, talking to an elected official that you have put into office about your expectations of the criminal justice system. When you say it, when the communities that aren't impacted by the criminal justice system say, I'm not satisfied, that's when you start to see change.
Do you sense that society at large is more open to the kinds of ideas you're pushing here?
Absolutely. Society at large, with the exception, obviously, of the sort of more traditional people who think you do the crime, you do the time. You have victims groups out here who sort of speak on behalf of all victims when the last year or so has been very interesting in terms of what victims actually want out of the criminal justice system, talking about people who are victimized multiple times of crime, wanting to see more rehabilitation and less punishment. You saw in the wake of the Attorney General Jeff Sessions' mandate to prosecutors that they go hard and high. You saw local officials saying, we are not going to do that. We do not follow that. You saw local police departments sort of thumbing their nose at the president and his immigration policies. You saw mayors telling the president what they thought about his policy on sanctuary cities. I think that there is a large movement towards reforming the system because we realize not just the humanity end, but it is such a waste of our money that we could be spending elsewhere.
You know, you founded the not-for-profit Prosecutor Impact Group. Right now you go to various jurisdictions and work with the attorneys there. What are some of the topics you cover with them when you do meet with them?
I cover a variety of topics that we aren't taught anywhere else, which are really germane to our job. So if you think about the job of a prosecutor, just fundamentally, our job is to affect human behavior. Somebody does something, we want to intervene so that they behave in a different way. And we never are taught about human behavior. We're never taught about adolescent brain development and how most of the people that we deal with are technically adolescents and how their brains work. We aren't taught about the alternatives to incarceration in our communities. We're not taught about trauma and how trauma drives violence. We're not taught about the differences between domestic violence and gang violence and stranger violence. We're not taught about a lot of these things, which would be really important if you're asking young people to make really high pressure decisions in really stressful situations. You wanted them at least equipped with baseline information. The other parts of the training are leadership, just how to maintain sort of a backbone in a really stressful environment, but also experiential learning. What does it feel like to be in a jail or a prison? Have you been into a homeless shelter and understood what goes on in there? Have you been to a mental health facility? Have you been to a drug treatment facility? These sorts of things are experiences that we don't have. We have the privilege not to have as prosecutors, as people coming out of law school, but they're important before we start impugning those decisions on other people.
That's interesting stuff. Adam Foss is the founder and president of Prosecutor Impact. You can hear how he became a social justice advocate from his 2016 TED Talk. That's available on YouTube. Adam, I really appreciate you taking some time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Adam Foss. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to look at the state of big labor in the state of Missouri and where things stand today. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, why meditation helps with stress and how outdated archetypes about the roles of moms and dads can strain relationships. You can find those conversations at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we find out how swarms of birds and bees help artificial intelligence programmers, and we'll get some scientific insight into Monday's solar eclipse. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this year, when Missouri lawmakers passed an anti-union right-to-work law, the move was seen as yet another body blow to organized labor. Some workers still look at it that way, but one of our guests now says that right-to-work doesn't have to be a death knell to any union. In fact, it could give organized labor a boost. Now an update on the state of organized labor in Missouri. With us is Jake Rosenfeld. He's a sociology professor at Washington University in St. Louis. He's the author of What Unions No Longer Do, that detailed the consequences of labor's decline. That book got a lot of attention a couple of years ago when it came out. Jake, good morning. It's nice to have you.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on.
We'll also be joined in a few minutes by Joe Manny. She's been covering Missouri politics and government for almost four decades, much of that time as a reporter and columnist at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. She'll be joining us from St. Louis Public Radio. Jake, in broad terms, what is right to work? Because there's confusion about it. Can you give us a two or three sentence definition here?
Sure. There's a lot of confusion out there on this issue. So right to work in general describes a situation in which you, as an employee at a unionized workplace, do not have to pay any union dues, despite the fact that the union legally has to represent you. So it allows you to opt out. You don't have to contribute to the union coffers in any way, shape, or form.
So this is seen as an anti-union piece of legislation when it's adopted.
Yes, absolutely. And it's now been adopted in about half the states.
I was going to say, how many states? It's roughly, what, 30, I think I read last time?
Upper 20s now. It was just beaten back in New Hampshire, I believe, but last year saw it pass in Kentucky and Missouri, obviously, although that's being challenged on the ballot, it looks like.
You know, there's this ongoing fight over right to work in Missouri. There's going to be a battle on the November ballot, it looks like, coming up here in the state. The storyline, for the most part, has been that this amounted to, as I mentioned, a huge defeat for organized labor, and I don't think there's any argument about that. But you say that labor can survive and even prosper, even in a right to work state. Explain that to me here.
Sure. I think, you know, my take on this issue is that right to work has assumed a symbolic importance that is probably far greater than its likely substantive impact. If you look at the research on right to work, it tends not to either usher in the kind of doomsday scenario for organized labor that unions put out or usher in the kind of economic boom that supporters of right to work suggest. Right to work in many states is associated with further declines in labor unions, but right to work is usually passed in states where unions have already been hurt, and that would certainly be the case here in Missouri.
There's not much question here that organized labor has been declining in most states, at least if you believe the stats that are out there.
Oh, absolutely. So over the past couple of decades here in Missouri, which was not a right-to-work state over this entire time period, the fraction of the private sector workforce that belongs to a labor union collapsed, from about 1 in 5 workers, if you go back to the early 1980s, to fewer than 1 in 10 today.
What states are you talking about, states that have right-to-work and where unions have still managed to do pretty well, Jake?
Yeah, so the state that people are looking at within the labor movement today is Nevada. Nevada is a right-to-work state. Nevada has a very kind of strong, powerful, and politically organized labor movement, and they've been able to maintain that despite the right-to-work environment. They've been able to convince union members, and especially a few key large locals, to keep paying union dues despite the fact that these members do not have to.
And how have they managed to do that? What techniques did they use to did unions use to keep themselves relevant?
Right, that's the critical question. Unfortunately, I don't think we have a great answer to it yet. It seems that these unions, especially the kind of culinary workers in the Las Vegas area, are just incredibly adept at maintaining member contact and convincing and showing members exactly what the union delivers to them on a day-to-day basis. So this can be just kind of water cooler talk at the office. This could be things like holding demonstrations, holding picnics, parties, and the like, making sure that the workers who are covered by union contracts know the role that the union plays in their lives.
And that seems to be working, at least in places like Nevada, you're saying.
Absolutely. So the vast, vast majority of workers who are covered by a union contract in Nevada pay union dues and pay union dues willingly. We're talking, 90 to 95% of them.
But still, you still contend that right-to-work laws tend to weaken unions overall?
Sure. The impact is small because right-to-work tends to follow, a precipitous union decline. These are laws designed to hurt unions, and they have that effect. I just think that their effect is oftentimes oversold in the kind of a public debate on the issue.
Let's step back and look at organized labor from another perspective. Why aren't unions today, soaring in membership, Jake, given the lack of growth in wages, given all the complaints that people are working longer and harder than ever? It would seem that the times are ripe for union growth. So why isn't that happening?
Absolutely. And I would add, if you look at national polls, you're seeing kind of an upsurge in support for labor unions. So why haven't unions kind of rebounded? I think that the pathways to new organizing on a substantial scale, especially in the private sector, are largely blocked for a variety of reasons. But first and foremost, as we saw in recent union election defeats in Tennessee, South Carolina, and Mississippi, employers have largely perfected an anti-union playbook that has now proven successful time and time again.
Which is what?
It is a range of tactics, everything from captive audience meetings where you bring everyone in the worksite together and tell them what exactly you think will happen if a union comes in, to the relationship between the employer and employee. It is threatening union supporters with termination, which is illegal, but happens, as we know, has been well documented in organizing drive after organizing drive. It is, as we saw in a recent failed unionization attempt at Nissan, it is promoting temporary workers under the condition that they don't support the union once they receive their promotion. There are a wide-ranging set of tactics that are incredibly effective at defeating unionization drive.
And Jake, how are unions supposed to fight back against all that?
I don't think they've figured it out yet. I think it's a very tough question. Unions have poured an enormous amount of resources and energies into modifying our labor laws to make it slightly easier to organize, to kind of tilt the balance a bit towards workers in these situations and towards unions. And they've failed at every turn. Politically, it's just proven a non-starter over the past few decades.
Let me bring into our conversation Joe Manes, who works for St. Louis Public Radio, longtime reporter and columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Joe, it's nice to have you back again.
Yeah, well, thanks for asking me, Steve.
And I should say we're talking about the state of big labor in the state of Missouri right now. You know, Joe, right to work is now the law of the land in Missouri. We're talking about that with Jake Rosenfeld here. But the fight over that law is hardly over. In fact, labor is trying to overturn that law. Can you bring us up to speed on what's been going on there?
Well, basically, it's not the law of the land until August 28th. And they're planning on turning in about 300,000 signatures on Friday in order to prevent its implementation. That's about three times the number needed to force a statewide referendum on the issue.
Huh.
And they're trying to turn in so many so that it's obvious that even if some get tossed out, that they'll make it. The Secretary of State, Jay Ashcroft, who supports right to work, but who has acknowledged that if they're turning in 300,000, he's planning to make sure the law, I mean, that the law technically will not be in place. So the law then stands in kind of a limbo situation until November 2018. And you've already got business groups who are kind of concerned about that, but that's sort of the stakes right now.
So you're saying that labor can actually negate this right to work law through this petition drive that's been going on now for a number of months?
Yes, but here's the thing. I mean, and everyone's already talking about this, is that this would be a referendum on the law that got passed and that the governor signed months ago, earlier this year. Well, there's nothing that's going to prevent the General Assembly and the governor from just approving a new one in 2019. We're saying if let's say the referendum succeeds, and there's no guarantee for many of the reasons that Professor Rosenfeld just outlined.
Okay, so if it succeeds, then will Missouri voters weigh in here at some point on this?
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, they would vote on November 2018 whether to keep the law or not. And if they vote in favor of keeping the law, then it goes into effect. Because, as I said, right now it's in, I mean, it's in limbo. It wasn't slated to go into effect until August 28th.
Mm-hmm.
With the signatures being turned in, Secretary of State Ashcroft has said, we've had him on a podcast here talking about it,
right,
has said that, well, you know, from his point of view, it will just be in limbo. Now, obviously, they have to make sure that there's 100,000 certified, and that could take a few weeks. But the point is, if they turn in so many, he's assuming they're probably going to have 100,000. And they also, instead of doing just 6 of 8 congressional districts, they did all 8.
I see. Again, to cover their bases and make sure that they've got enough to do what they're trying to do here, which is to negate this law.
Right, right. But as I'm sure, you know, the General Assembly knows this too, this is just a temporary fix. Now, I think the labor may be assuming that if it, let's say, if the referendum succeeds, they may believe that the General Assembly and the governor won't want to turn around and overturn what the public voted on. But you and I have both known that there's a number of cases on other issues where they go ahead and do that. I mean, where it's happened.
So again, just to slow down here a little bit, you're saying that if they have enough signatures, the law goes into limbo, there'll be a
right.
statewide vote in November of 2018, so
right.
a year and several months from now. And do I have all that right?
Yes.
Okay. And then in the meantime, Joe, just to not to delve into the weeds too deeply here, there's a separate initiative effort going on to overturn this law. Do I have that right?
No. The separate thing would be to, so you've got the referendum to knock out this current law, which would be in limbo, as
right.
I said, if they turn in as many signatures as they say they have. Separately, they're trying to do an initiative petition drive on a constitutional amendment
right.
that would prevent any such law from being put in place in the future. And from a strategic standpoint, they probably need that to prevent the General Assembly or the governor from just putting a new one in place in 2019. But this could confuse voters if they're looking at two different, the wording may be slightly different. Maybe they have to vote yes on one and no on the other. And they're going to be on the same ballot. I mean, it could be a confusing situation in 2018. They have not been focusing on the initiative that much right now because they have until May to turn that in. This, the referendum, they had to get that in right away.
You know, Joe, you've covered politics in this state for almost 4 decades. And just for the record, let me say you've covered it longer than I have. So it's I'm safe there. But what's your sense of the tenor of the state of Missouri? Is it do people want right to life or do they prefer it to be a more right to work or do they want a more a pro-union kind of stance in this state?
I think people aren't sure. I think for the average, I mean, as the professor has discussed, less than 10% of the overall workforce in Missouri is unionized. And that's about half of what it was the last time it was on the ballot in 78. But there's a lot of other things that have changed. You know, we had shoe factories, glass clothing factories, all these unionized factories that are no longer here. Most of them are no longer even in our country. So I think for the average voter, both sides have to try to explain why this matters to them, why they should care. So each side is, you know, going to be putting out what they say is the reason why people who technically might not be affected, explaining to them, no, this does affect you,
right?
And this is how. And you've seen that on other issues as well over the years.
Jake Rosenfeld, again, from Washington University over in St. Louis. Is Missouri right now sort of ground zero in the battle for organized labor's soul, or what's your sense?
That's a good question. Certainly this battle over right to work has assumed of national import. So you have money flowing in from national labor unions and from outside groups for groups that oppose or that are pushing this particular measure. One thing that I want to stress is that even if unions are successful in this drive and successful in getting this placed in the state constitution so it can't come up again, that only returns the state of organized labor to the kind of status quo that we see today, which is one of an incredibly weakened position, certainly looking back historically.
Now, you get a sense, Jake, that organized labor, again, I'm speaking broadly here, even outside the state of Missouri, has a public relations problem. I mean, unions have a darker connotation today than they used to have, or am I wrong about that?
Actually, public opinion polls have held pretty steady and show that, if you just ask Americans for their general support of unions one way or the other, the majority says they support them. It breaks down, like everything does these days, on partisan lines. For unions, and I think this should offer them some cause for optimism, younger Americans and younger workers tend to have an even more positive view of labor unions. Right to work's a tougher one. That's a tough issue to explain. I think right to work supporters did a brilliant job branding it right to work. Who wants to oppose that? And so on the kind of national polls that we've looked at, right to work is actually supported by a majority of Americans as well.
Joe Manny's from St. Louis Public Radio. Just as an aside here, to what extent do labor struggles in Missouri match the decline of Democrats in statewide offices in the state, as well as the General Assembly for that matter?
Well, I think the state Democratic Party and many other Democratic candidates in Missouri and in other states rely heavily on unions for money and for volunteers, kind of the field organization, so to speak. And so some would say, well, the decline of unions has hurt that. But I think, though, it's a bit more complicated. This goes back to the 1980s when Ronald Reagan, when he ran for president, was able to peel off an estimated 30% or so of regular rank-and-file union members to vote for him. And I think when you look at what happened in Missouri last November, there's no way to know. But most union leaders even acknowledge that it's pretty clear, with Trump winning with about 19 points, that there were some of their members that voted for Trump and then went ahead and voted for Republicans all the way down the ticket. Now, I've run into Republicans, labor people who've said privately, these are just rank-and-file workers, who say they had no idea that Greitens was going to go for right to work, even though Greitens made it very clear during his campaign that he was in support of right to work. But I think people weren't paying attention that much because they were focusing on the presidential race. So the bottom line is, I think it's complicated. I think that Democrats are trying to expand who they appeal to. But in the Midwest, unions remain a powerful force, not as powerful as they were. But much of this voter dissatisfaction, especially among middle-aged whites and people of color who used to have jobs in factories and don't, and now maybe work for a fraction of that, that unrest, that economic unrest, is something that both parties have been trying to tap into. But right now, I don't think Democrats have been as successful.
In your book, Jake, What Unions No Longer Do, you talk just what Joe was talking about, that is the consequences of labor's decline over the years. What stands out to you on that front?
I would agree completely with Joe in terms of the political consequences. The decline of organized labor has hurt Democratic Party on various levels, state, local, and national. And I think it's taken the Democratic Party probably up till this past election to really come to grips with just how kind of devastating losing that organizational and financial base has been. Something that the Republicans have spent now decades at really successfully chipping away at. And that's something that it might be a little too late for Democrats to try to regain that strength.
What about some other consequences of labor's decline, Jake?
Sure. So one thing that I think oftentimes gets missed and kind of speaks to ongoing efforts today to raise minimum wage and do other things to help kind of bottom-end occupations is that when organized labor was strong, in those places where organized labor was strong especially, there was positive spillover effects for non-union workers. You know, even at the labor movement's peak, the majority of American workers didn't belong to a labor union, but they benefited from the wages and working conditions that unions were able to negotiate. Non-union employers, we know, matched what unions were doing in order to kind of head off an organizing drive or to retain the loyalty of their own workforce.
Just quickly, Jake, you say one of those consequences also is weakened support for immigrants' economic assimilation. That was interesting to me. How big a problem is that?
Yeah, so we know that kind of the southern and eastern European migrant populations of the late 19th and early 20th century, that they relied, and their children relied, too, on a strong labor movement to assimilate them economically. And kind of that helped build the middle class and help kind of integrate the millions of Irish, Italian, and others who came to this country. Without that latter today, with a really weakened labor movement, we see a really kind of split economy where you have lots of, especially new arrivals, toiling in low-paying jobs that offer little security or few benefits.
Jake Rosenfeld is with Washington University. He's the author of What Unions No Longer Do. Joe Manis is with St. Louis Public Radio. Thank you both for a very good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is back with this week's Local Listen. Talk about a local musical group that's doing some interesting stuff. And Bill, how are you?
I'm well, Steve.
Tell me about Soul Revival.
As a music critic, Steve, I appreciate when the name of an ensemble immediately signals its sound and intent. You know, for instance, if a punk band was named Angry Noise, that'd be helpful. But with Soul Revival, we know immediately what we're getting with the kind of music this Kansas City band makes.
Let's listen to the track Fall in Love from the group's new EP, Back to Love.
Just wanna let go. In the party, see somebody that you wanna dance with. Now all we need is some good music that we can step with.
The groove is right, right. The vibe is tight. Let's dance tonight.
And everybody's having a good time.
That Soul Revival, that's pretty smooth stuff, Bill. That gets you moving.
That's right. And speaking of moving, it's the vocalist there, Derek Joseph Cunningham, referenced step dancing. And clearly with that beat, you know, this is a song designed for line dancing on the floors of nightclubs.
And what dance moves would you bust out with a song like this?
I'm a great step dancer, Steve.
Are you?
Oh, yeah.
Did not know this. Yeah. This is a Kansas City group, right?
That's right. The music is composed by a guy named Desmond Mason, who kind of crosses over between jazz and R&B with a number of groups in town. But the band is playing Saturday at Record Bar, and there they'll have a bunch of like-minded people. For instance, Chris Hazelton, the jazz funk organist, will be in the band. Dominique Sanders, the jazz
sure.
and funk and points beyond bassist, will be in the group. as well as a couple of women singing, and Derek, as I mentioned.
This group has its own songs, but they play some classics too. What are some of the hits that they end up covering?
Well, they're going to play a lot. You know, in addition to these great original songs, like the one we're hearing now, and a song called If You Ask Me Again, I Do, which is one of my favorite songs out of Kansas City in recent years. But yeah, they'll sing some Luther Vandross, they'll sing some Music Soul Child, maybe some Marvin Gaye, you know, things like that.
Okay, and Soul Revival performs again at the Record Bar on Saturday, right?
That is correct.
That's Bill Brownlee talking about this week's Local Listen, the group Soul Revival. Thanks a lot, Bill. Appreciate
Thanks.
It. Follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. You can download our podcast and listen to previous programs at kcur.org/up to date. On tomorrow's show, what programmers can learn from swarms of bees, and we'll get some scientific perspectives into Monday's big solar eclipse. Denny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar produce this program. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.